All right, we're recording.
The time is 6:34. The chair will call the Human Services meeting of August 27th, 2013 to order. Ms. Davis, could you please call the roll?
David Holman?
Present.
Aaron Decker?
Here.
Angie Montemurro? Not here. Did you hear anything from her?
Nope.
Gabe Newell?
Here.
Anita Johnson?
Here.
Lindsay Allen?
Here.
Alicia Skalitsky?
Here.
Boyd Frederick?
Here.
David Arrington? Did you hear from David?
Okay, citizen comments. If there are any citizens who wish to speak, please step forward and address the committee. You have 5 minutes. State your name and address for the record. And in the time it took to say that, no one has come forward. Okay. Seeing none, citizen comments are closed. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Nudo, second by Supervisor Decker. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Youth and Governance.
Youth and Governance vote aye. The committee votes aye. So we just take the other set of minutes from 6/11/2013, or? I mean, does it?
I actually thought we're approving both of them at the same time. But
all right. Does it matter, anybody? Formally, we're okay, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Agenda item 4, approval of county executive appointments as follows. Brian Wolf to the Workforce Development Board and Terry Jacobson to the Racine Kenosha Community Action Agency Board.
I'll start with Dr. Wolf. Dr. Wolf has been very involved since being named as doctor to Mr. Houghton. He has extensive work and in-depth knowledge of participants using the services provided at the KCJC. He has very good attendance record on various other committees. He attends at the job center, like executive management. And we look forward with the committee's approval of Dr. Wolf serving on the workforce board. He is here tonight if you have any questions of him. Okay.
Motion to approve the appointment.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Decker, second by. You two can fight this out. Who wants it?
Oh, please.
Second by Supervisor Frederick. Youth and Governance?
Aye.
Aye.
Be emphatic about it. Yeah. Like you're hiding in the weeds or something. Committee?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Mr. Wolf is reconfirmed. Or confirmed. Yeah.
Your second appointment doesn't need an introduction. I believe everybody knows Ms. Jacobson, who's the Kenosha County Treasurer. We're asking her to be appointed to the Racine Kenosha Community Action Agency Board, be a two-year term that would run through August 2015. She would serve without pay, and she would be filling a vacancy on that board for Kenosha County. She is here. Do you have any questions?
Do you want to sit in a pretty chair?
I don't know. Do you want me to sit in the chair?
Yeah, why not?
Motion approved.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Johnson, second by Supervisor Decker.
Oh, come on. We have her in the hot seat. We're getting her out. Letting her go that easily?
Come on. Let's vote. Let's get right of her.
This is a unique opportunity. I think we should talk for a while about it.
Should we do
it?
I'm pretty sure people on the rest of the agenda might have something to say about that.
Don't forget, we can talk behind our back all the time. So.
Purple.
What will you be serving at your birthday party?
No, the menu is yet to be determined.
Anyone? Okay, there's been a motion, there's been a second. It's on the record, right? Okay.
Yes.
Youth and Governance?
Aye.
You make a nay, make sure it's that strong, too. Committee?
Aye.
Aye.
The chair votes aye. Thank you. Agenda item 5, Department of Human Services second quarter financial report.
Now we can ask questions.
Yes, you may. Okay, this is our second quarter report, so we have the information through June. However, Aging and Disability Services, we only have some information through May because a lot of our institutes and our residential placements come in later. So we based it upon through May 31st. So altogether for our divisions of Aging and Disability Services, DCFS, Health, Medical Examiner, Veterans, and workforce development, at this point in time, we would be requesting a need of levy of $152,000. Brookside, I have put at the bottom now because of the, in 2012, the general fund is at 17%, so they got to keep some of their excess. So I'm just putting it below the line. However, they are making their budget of their levy being returned, of their operating revenues being returned. So this 244 is over and above that. So it is possible that they would be able to use it. So if we did that, the department as a whole then comes in with a surplus of just under $100,000. On pages 2 and 3 are for disability, aging and disability services. 2 has the numbers, but I think 3 with the graphs might tell a little better story. Our hospitals, our number of admissions are up and down. We were a little bit lower in April, but then we had more emergency for hospital admissions in May and June. And those average right now about $583 a day. Our institutes, which are the emergency detentions, we started the year off pretty bad in the first quarter, but we have a little bit more control in the second quarter. However, there have been 2 very long stay outliers starting last November through at least, I believe, July, I think they were getting out. And you can see that on the average length of stay graph for the 2013 year to date. The red bars down below are the average length of stay for the institutes, and you can see that it has really grown, and it's because of those 2 outliers. It averages 10.5 days on an average length of stay. And we are using the care center more, which is through Kenosha Human Development Services, and they're averaging $445 a day, our costs on that. So it's better that we use the care center more and keep them out of the hospital space.
How much do we have budgeted for each?
On the
number
page,
wise.
On the page 2, the state institutes for the budgeted, we have for the whole year 735 days, and through May, you can see that that's May 31st up there at the column heading. We have already 813 days, so we are over. And that is our biggest, remember, that's emergency detentions, and that's our biggest need right now for money, for additional money. But we're always working on putting, you know, them in the safest place, but getting them out of the institute sooner and into a more appropriate setting for their, for the client. On page 4 is just Children and Family Services. You can see their placement numbers. And in page 5 is their graph. We are breaking even. I think after a couple years, we finally got our budget to kind of equal to what we're actually spending. So there's just a very close break-even point on that. And then for page 6 and 7, we have the medical examiner. And page six, has all the statistics. And last year, year to date, total for the 2012, there's 166. It's up at the very top of the page in the middle column. So we had 166 deaths that we investigated. We're already at 80 through June 30th. So we're running about 160 again. We can straight line death. I don't know how you do that. That's how we're doing it, to showing our actuals. And on page 7, you can see the manner of deaths. And again, our accidental deaths are broken apart on the bottom of the page. And our drug overdoses are extremely high for this through June 30th again. For Brookside, pages 8 and 9, 8 are simply the numbers, and then 9 is our census mix. And I think that kind of tells a better story for you. Yeah, we have at the very top for this year, for 2013, the first section is Medicare, and we had budgeted 33 average daily census. And year-to-date through July, I have July numbers in there, 31st, we have 39.1. So we're 6.1 days ahead of the game.
37.1. 37.1.
No.
Year-to-date.
Average, okay. I'm sorry.
Year-to-date average is 39.1. So we are ahead, and remember, this is what helps our bottom line. It almost brings $300 a day to help offset our Medicaid population and then any other type of expenditures over and above the budget. Medicaid, we lose about $120 to $140 a day on Medicaid patients. We had budgeted 88, we're at 80, but that's good. That's good news. And our private pay, we had budgeted 30, and we're very, very close at 29.8. So, and private pay is meant to have a break-even status. We are at a 98.6% occupancy rate, which is wonderful. I'm not sure how many commercial nursing homes can say that. And you can see that the graphs down below from 08 depict how our census has been climbing for Medicare, decreasing for Medicaid, and we're kind of leveling off now at private pay, somewhere between 28 and 30, I think we're been sitting the last few months.
Any questions?
I'll be doing the third quarter during our budget hearings in October. We'll have a preliminary third quarter on the same night. I did that the last couple of years.
Do we need a motion to approve this?
Supervisor Johnson.
Remembering the overage from both sides, was there a plan to use part of that for the expansion? Was there a plan at all to set aside some of it for when we?
Well, we budgeted. We didn't budget for anything for the expansion in 2013 because we budgeted last year this time, and it was unknown. Mm-hmm. As to what. So maybe after our third quarter or getting towards the end of the year with the county exec, we can discuss that and, you know, help with the plans. Because we'll know further on to, like, in November, December, just how much over and above the budget that they'll be able to bring in. But I'm sure it will help. Our debt service, by the way, is being paid off this month in September. So
that's awesome.
For next year, we're done.
It's awesome.
And then the expansion starts.
But then, so too, will increase revenue.
Yes, we are hoping, because they're at 39, you know, and they're averaging that. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, that's great. If we can keep that up, then that just goes to show we can fill those cuts.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. With the expansion.
Anyone else? Okay. Agenda item 6, Emergency Services Network presentation.
And supervisors, and youth and governance members, and assorted sundry staff of government services. I'm Teddy Winnett, and I'm director of the Kenosha County UW Extension Office, and with me this evening are two other members of the Emergency Services Network. They happen to be currently the two co-chairs, and they'll introduce themselves.
Pam Hallbacher, Kenosha Community Action Agency, the Kenosha NRF Director.
Byron Wright, Executive Director of Kenosha Human Development Services.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here tonight to talk a bit about the Emergency Services Network, ESN. And in particular, we want to highlight for you how those resources that the county provides through ESN is utilized and impacted in the Kenosha County community. So let me start with a bit about who ESN is. We're three of the organizations that comprise the consortium. It's a countywide consortium of approximately 40 organizations, as I look through the two of you, that comprise a wide variety of organizations designed to, following our mission, strengthen the delivery of emergency services to meet the basic needs. And we do this by working together through coordinated planning, collaborative strategies, and public advocacy. Many of you know that as UW Extension, we're not necessarily a direct service provider. We provide education and partner with organizations through various venues. So we are one organization that sort of, I would say, contributes in a unique way, unlike a food pantry who gives direct delivery or the Shalom Center that provides direct housing. Kenosha Human Development Services providing direct housing, PAMS organization, Community Action Agency providing WIC. We are one of the many organizations actually that support in a different way or contribute through ESN in a non-direct delivery method. So why are we here tonight? Well, you all are the oversight for the Department of Human Services, and it's through that department where much of the individual needs in this community are met. And starting with where families begin and where families are challenged is all around poverty. No surprise, some of this information is going to be second nature to you. You've seen it in other venues, but we're just going to highlight little snippets of it tonight to help you see. And this darn thing did this to me the last time. I think I could have fixed that, huh? Look at these guys. I think I should have fixed that little part. And never mind. Poverty is defined by the federal government as $23,550 for a family of four. It's an annual income. And they determine that as the minimum resources needed to support a family. One of the things that I'm sure you've heard over and over again from my colleagues in the Department of Human Services is those numbers are really, in many ways, difficult to determine. The actual guidelines for these numbers were created in the 1960s. So think about that. Over 50 years ago, those numbers were created, and we're still using those same criteria to determine poverty today. So you hear the term poverty threshold. Well, that's a term the Census Bureau uses to report how many Americans are living in poverty. And we do know that in the city of Kenosha, we're at 15.5% of individuals. Kenosha County is at 11.6%, and the state of Wisconsin is at 12%. The department uses the poverty threshold as a way to calculate their eligibility for many programs. So you'll see that term used quite frequently for many programs. So how do families know where they fall, or what does it cost for a family to live? One of the resources we've come across is from the Economic Policy Institute. And I actually have an article, I have copies that I could share with some of you who are interested. They've created a family budget calculator that actually helps families determine what they need to get by. And that's just basic living expenses. The unique piece about this particular resource is that it does take into account where you're living. So it does allow you to put in the state and the city where you are, so that, and the number of family members that you have, how your family is, household is comprised. So you get a sense of about what it costs to live. Had we done this, and I didn't want to take the time, but had we done this, we could have put a family in the calculator, compared that against the poverty guidelines, and just see how challenging it is for families, knowing what we know today and what wages they're making. So keep in mind that the online resource is available and something that we could share with others. So what can poverty mean? Again, sort of listening to the way the budget is being distributed, you're so aware of this in a real life situation and how families manage around reduced resources. So we recognize that they often live with hunger and food insecurity, in some cases homelessness, in many cases victimization. They can find themselves in an unsafe environment, often challenged with affording health care, probably experiencing poor health, often unable to meet their basic needs. For children, it can mean failing in school, and for so many of them, it is a loss of hope. Some facts we're going to share. In May of this year, Kenosha County's unemployment rate was 7.7. Over the last several years, we have lost many jobs, as you all are aware, through closings of many of our corporations. Chrysler, Super Value Distribution Center, Unified Solutions, Synveco, Synveo, let me say that correctly, that's the envelope company, Unemployment Solutions. I should look at Doug and ask him for the list, because he could probably recite it better than I could. However, on a bright note, he and I were just chatting earlier about opportunities that are coming. So we're hopeful, and we know many of our stakeholders and elected officials are doing what they can to bring more jobs to the Kenosha County community so that we can see a reversal in some of this and actually bring forward worthy paying jobs for livable wages. Some more facts about the faces in our Kenosha County community. 50% of our single-parent families with small children are living in poverty. 20.5% of all children in our county are living in poverty. And we have approximately 376 homeless children and youth attending school. I say approximately because, you know, those numbers are really very difficult to capture. The school districts do maintain and are required to maintain a category of who is homeless. So where families who don't have a permanent housing, maybe they're living with relatives or they're doubling up with families. And as you can imagine, schools trying to keep up with that, it's very, very challenging. So that's an approximation of children that we know. Let's jump to food security. When you hear the term food security, insecurity, what does it mean? Well, households that are food insecure don't have enough food for an active, healthy life. They often have uncertain access to food, meaning the ability to purchase it. So location in terms of being able to buy quality food within a reasonable distance. And it can mean not having enough money to buy more food when food runs out. That could be due to the lack of money in some cases, or they find themselves, I should say, they cut back on the size of meals due to their lack of money, or in some cases they actually skip meals because there just isn't enough to go around. And so it's typically those families that we see will be utilizing our food pantries more regularly and frequently. We know based upon calendar year 2012 that there were 40,131 unduplicated food share recipients here in Kenosha. We also know, and I mentioned the food pantries, that many, many families utilize the resources of the food pantries here in Kenosha County. And our data from those food pantries show that last year they served 4,635 individuals. And at the Shalom Center, which is our hot meal site, they served 55,650. So the numbers are quite startling and certainly puts into perspective the need for additional resources, as all of you are very, very aware. I'm going to pass the clicker. He can deal with this little thing that jumps ahead all the time to Byron to talk about housing.
Okay. To start out.
It's the tricks.
Gotcha. Okay. And I'm not very electronically inclined as it is. Twice a year in Kenosha and pretty much all over the United States now, the number of people that are homeless in communities are counted. We count the last week of January and the last week of July. And so in trying to figure out, and this is something that HUD's been doing for years, because HUD has a lot of grants to provide housing for people who are homeless. And what they're trying to figure out is, how are those numbers staying over the years? And so they said, let's do a point in time count twice a year. The Emergency Services Network kind of puts that count together for Kenosha. Excuse me, in January of this year, we identified 190 people who were homeless in January. 76 of those were in emergency shelter. That's either the family shelter for the Shalom Center, or the Shalom Center runs a shelter that moves from church to church called the ENDS program. That capacity ranges around 30 to 40. There were 96 people in transitional housing, and those are all people that by HUD's definition either came out of the emergency shelter or were homeless and on the streets when they entered the program. And then there were 18 people that were unsheltered that night. And actually in January, because I was out counting, it was about 4 degrees and windy. Most of those people were at First Step. And First Step is kind of a drop-in center where people can stay awake during the winter and stay there. And then there were 4 people who were out who were looking for shelter but were refused, because some people have a real hard time doing kind of what they're supposed to. So that kind of gives you an idea of the numbers. The unsheltered count that we just did in July, there were about 28 people that we found that night. And so we go out and count twice. We count from about 10 to 2 and then 2 to 6. We have 2 different shifts, because then you catch the people who are getting up. And it's always surprising to me that you find people in Kenosha who are sleeping on sidewalks wrapped up in blankets. So in the shelters in Kenosha in 2012, we had 21,905 nights in the emergency shelters in Kenosha. And we have 33,324 people who received medical assistance monthly in the county. Oh, there it comes. All right. The Shalom Center added an eighth room in the family shelter this year because they just were always full. They have about 100 families on the waiting list at any given time. The other thing is the ENDS program that moves among different churches in the community has about 30 beds on any given night. And most of the time, the ENDS program is also full and sometimes full to overflowing. One of the things that Kenosha has done over the years, and our agency in particular has done, the other big provider in Kenosha is to provide transitional housing units for people. This is where we get people who are homeless, and we provide them with housing which is subsidized, and then supportive services that essentially, our goals really are always the same. We want to teach them the skills necessary to maintain housing. We want to help them get a job so they can pay for that housing. And then we want to help them develop some sort of support system, because what we have observed over the years is that people with little or no support system don't do very well in life. So those are the kind of things that you work on. We can work with people for 18 to 24 months. Between us and Women's and Children's Horizons at any given time, we normally have about 57 units that are HUD-funded. Once people start to work, they pay 30% of their income toward housing, and then when they start doing that, then when we kind of build that money up, then we just add more people onto the program. Probably, at least certainly from my perspective, I've been at Kenosha Human Development Services for 31 years and wrote the original HUD grants in 1990, when we got this money. And what I found is really interesting over the years is the luxury of being in the same place for a long time is you get to see how well a lot of people do. 65% of the people who come out of our programs go into permanent housing. We're very close now to being able, within a year, to come back and give you a report that should be able to tell you if they entered another emergency shelter anywhere in the state 6 months later or a year later. There's a database called ServicePoint that we've all suffered through for 13 years that we're finally getting some good information out of. And so, say if someone gets homeless services in Kenosha and they show up in Superior, Superior knows we've dealt with them. So, and we kind of trade information back and forth. But, you know, to me, I mean, the way I look at it sometimes is about, and I won't use any names or anything, but about 4 years ago, I had somebody walk through our doors at Kids to apply for a job at a professional job that required a master's degree. And she looked at the person who was interviewing her and said, I've wanted to work here for 20 years. And I'm like, well, why? And she said, well, when I was 18, I was on the streets, I was pregnant and had no place to live, and y'all took me in. And you kept me for 9 months and you helped me get into college, and then your worker for another year met with me informally once a month. She got a master's degree. She's working for us. So those are the types of things to me. What I've observed overall is people take the services that we give them and they do better. And there are people who, you know, there are people who don't get near that far sometimes, who have a lot more barriers to overcome. The other population we really target in our agency are single parents with small children, because those first years of children's lives, if they don't go well, tend to have they have a huge impact kind of forever. So, you know, if you can work with single parents when they're young and teenagers aren't the best people in the world lots of times raising kids, you can cut off a lot of problems before they happen. So I'll move on to shares and food and Pam all back.
Okay. So, I'll get my dress with me. And so just what the application looks like, just to give you an idea.
one for you, one for you. That's two. Okay. Stickers.
Okay. So how does SHARES help? SHARES funding for 2013 and previous last couple of years has been $150,000. And the source of the funding is the Kenosha County Department of Human Services. What ESN does is sets priorities on how those dollars are going to be used. One of the funding priorities is food. And what happens in food, shelter, and rental assistance. And the application that I passed around shows what the agencies that are applying for, the form that they fill out. We've refined the process over the last couple of years, and now what happens is after all the applications come in, a group of people who aren't applying for the funds reviews them and makes the determination. So last year for food, the agencies that were awarded were First Step Services, Salvation Army, Shalom Center, Sharing Center, Racine Kenosha Community Action Agency, and Twin Lakes Area Food Pantry. Much of these dollars went directly for food for the food pantries. Our agency also runs the TFAP program, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, where we bring over 240,000 pounds of food to the food pantries to help distribute each year. So some of that funding went to support that. And then we wrote a real small request for SHARES to assist. We run a program called Cupboard Bound or Commodity Supplement Food Program for seniors who they get a food box every year. And we worked with one of the sites called Trinity Lutheran Church to provide 55 seniors with some vouchers that look like this for the summer months where they could come and use these at the farm stand that we have for our WIC population. It was really to see would the seniors use these, would be able to get to our office okay, and what would they think. So it's been a pilot project, and so far it's been fabulous too. The seniors are coming. They're very appreciative. But the other thing I noticed too is that they're also they shop very differently than some of us others, so they've been really actually working with some of our families too on the best way to pick out a watermelon or what to look for when they're picking out the food too. So that is the one of the funding priorities. The other is shelter. The Shalom Center and the Women and Children's Horizons receive funding for this, the Shalom Center primarily for the IMS program. And then rental assistance, kids. This year is providing rental assistance for those households without minor dependent children. And that tends to be a population where it's really difficult to get funding for is to assist those folks. And how does ESN help? We meet monthly, and there's been about 30 that have been at the table consistently month after month, and with the exception of December. And we really share information on different resources on different situations. Generally, there's a speaker that will come to update the different agencies. With the Affordable Care Act coming to, more and more information on that is being shared to the local agencies as well. So this just gives you an idea of some of the folks at the table. And I don't want to go through all of these, but it really just gives you an idea of the different organizations in the community that are part of the emergency services network. And so we just wanted really today to take that opportunity to thank you for those dollars and really supporting ESN and the agencies that are part of ESN. Questions?
I do have one question.
Supervisor Jackson?
And I'm going to regress back to a statistic that you had up in the very first presentation. I didn't want to interrupt. It's that 50% of all single-family homes, children in single-family homes, are at poverty level. What's the ratio of single-family homes to couple-family homes in Kenosha County? That seems staggering behind me, and I would think there are quite a few single-family homes. So do we know? I mean, like, is every one out of three a single-family home? I think it would be quite high these days.
I don't know the statistic off the top of my head, but again, think about of all single parent households, 50% of those have children.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm trying to quantify it in my head as to the overall population. Because I would assume, what is it, maybe one out of three would be a single player.
Sure.
These days, it seems like it would be quite high.
I just had the community snapshot in my hand today that we did for United Way, and it was in there, and I had it in my hand, but I didn't bring it. But I bet it, I thought it has to be high, right?
Yes. That's just staggering. It shocked me to see that.
They actually go out and
That information should be made available through the U.S. Census Bureau.
For Kenosha County?
Because that information is available like countywide.
And regularly updated now with the American Community Survey, so that we don't have to wait every 10 years for the new data that comes out. They're doing an American Community Survey every year with selected populations so that hopefully we get better and accurate information.
I'm trying to Google it now, so if I can get you an answer, I will.
Technology.
Yes. To follow up on hers.
Supervisor Decker.
So you're asking.
I'm sorry, was there anything else, Supervisor Johnson?
Well, you know, I was trying to quantify it compared to the 20%. Is that what you're getting at, the 20% number? But since we don't have any overall figures of the exact totals, it's hard to figure out the numbers from.
Right.
Because we don't know 20% of what.
I just wanted to make sure that. Supervisor?
My question, as long as you're asking about the percentage countywide that are single-family homes, my question would be the opposite of what are the not single-family homes, and what percentage of them are in poverty? I'd like to know the opposite answer, I guess.
Absolutely, and if we had the overall number, we could do that, because
right.
It's 20% overall. Are at poverty level.
By various households.
That's overall. So we would just take 50%. If we could get a number somewhere, we could figure it all
right.
out. But
we can make sure we can get that so that you have some current data.
I'm sure it's also broken out by elderly versus.
Sure.
You know, and that's another thing I was thinking too when you were saying that with funding, it's hard to get. I suppose that changes a little bit once you reach senior citizen age. Is it easier once you get into that elderly age? Or is it just as difficult as an adult, childless home?
For food?
For aid, or for, you know, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
I think there's
aid.
More programs available for those with children, too. And one of the families that, with this, just this pilot, small pilot project that we're doing, one of the daughters of the seniors called and just thanked us for even doing this, and she kind of referred to it as, a lot of times the seniors are the silent hungry. Yeah.
You know, so you would think... I would hope
yeah.
it would be some kind of a curve where
mm-hmm.
it would be easier as you got into those elderly years and not be as difficult as, you know, we tend to think that when we're young and healthy, people aren't sympathetic and don't provide as much.
Mm-hmm.
But you would think when they start to get older again and not as capable, that there would be more for them available.
Mm-hmm.
Again, our purpose was to make sure you knew where those dollars were being spent and to say thank you for the continued support for the SHARES funding, that they are, we hope you see, well used and the impact is tremendous. It's never enough, I have to say that.
I was just going to say the numbers are staggering.
Yeah,
I mean, compared to what we're doing, that the overall numbers are staggering.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like
we were
events.
Just looking... Pam, you looked earlier about how the number has not changed. Right?
Since I was going back to old minutes in that too, from what I had access to, and somewhere between 2002 and 2004, it jumped from 135,000 to 150,000, and it's been at 150,000.
So for the last 10 years.
Thanks. If you look at, I think it was like between 5,000 and 6,000 hot meals. Figure 50% of the single family homes are poverty level.
Mm-hmm. It's reaching a small
area. Anyone else? I may have just found the answer to your question. I'm trying really hard to find it. Any other questions from the committee? Or?
Thanks for the opportunity. We really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's not it. The next agenda item, job services manager. Good evening, Mr. Bartz.
Good evening. Hello again. I just tried to come with some interesting information.
This time I brought some updated unemployment numbers and some information on things that we're doing around the job center. Kenosha County right now is 11th in the state at 8.3%. We are coming down. Now in May we were at 7.7%. In June we saw a spike and now it's coming back down. The reason for the spike was the labor force grew. And when the labor force grows, more people are unemployed. And we see that because of the number of job postings. I'm sure everybody's aware of the number of companies that are opening in the area. So we're seeing more people interested joining back into that labor force. And how that's counted is being on job search. So when they take the survey of job seekers, are you actively searching for a job? The answer is yes, you're in the labor force. If your answer is no, they follow it up with how long have you not been looking for a job. If you have not been looking for a job for a consecutive almost 4 weeks, you are not considered in the labor force. So it's sort of a play on numbers, but that is how they do it. Southeast, the reason why we don't seem to be going down as fast as the rest of the state at 6.8%, is because we're lumped in with Racine. And Racine is the highest in the state right now at 12.3% unemployment. So they've been sort of teetering back and forth on that. But where everyone else is starting to trend down, Racine is trending up. Their unemployment is growing every month. So, you know, we're in with them. A lot of people say, well, what about Lake County? Lake County's having the same issue. So we're actually doing better than that. And that is surprising because we are included in that statistical area with Northern Illinois and not Wisconsin. Again, in the duel of two cities, Caledonia's the lowest in the state at 4%. So some interesting numbers there. Some of the things that we're doing at the job center, we recently just had a mini job fair. And what that was, it was very geared and very specific for very entry-level workers, because that seems to be where we have the highest unemployment, the younger generations. So we had a very impromptu, very entry-level, where we had 5 staffing agencies attend. We only had a total of about 87 job seekers come in. And like I said, though, we geared that at a lower level. It is something that we thought was successful and something that we want to continue doing. I don't know about every month, but probably every other month. It's not going to be something that we are going to go out and advertise as much as we would our normal job fairs, because we are keeping it very specific to that very entry level. On the flip side of that, September 10th, you all have a flyer, is our big county job fair at Montgomery. Something interesting is happening with this. Typically, 2 weeks before our job fairs, I could only tell you of a couple companies that we have signed up to come. Companies do not plan that far in advance. They tend to come to our job fairs last minute. And I'm actually pleased to announce that we are almost to capacity already with our job fair. A lot of companies are coming out a lot earlier than we expected, paying the fees to actually be there, so we haven't had anybody even request a waiver of our job fair fee yet. So I think those are all very good signs on why we're trending down and going to continue to trend down. And of course, with the Meyer warehouse, they're renovating the old SuperValu warehouse that's well underway. There's new warehouses that are being built or considered being built in the area. And right to our north on Highway 11H is UNFI, which is United Natural Foods. Another huge, and they deal with organic foods. So just in those two areas alone, we're looking at probably about 1,000 to 1,200 jobs in the area in the next year. So we're very excited for that. And then last, and I don't think anybody has a handout on this. I looked into the Career Tools Conference. That was provided at the chair's request. And it was a conference geared towards job seekers in the Milwaukee area that was put on by the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. Yes, sir.
Sorry, Dana. This is actually Supervisor Frederick's question.
Oh, I thought it, you know, had generated from you.
Yeah. He's not here.
Okay.
He's out there. He is out there.
Is he on his phone?
No, he's talking to his phone.
I have a question in the interim.
Yeah.
When you have the job fairs, do you ever have job fairs for people who are finding it difficult, their histories, people with convictions, or, you know, do you ever have job fairs that are geared for people who are hard to place?
It's a very difficult proposition to do that, because what you're doing is you're asking a company to put that information out. And that's not something companies usually would like to put out, that hiring felons.
Yeah, I guess that would be
it's
well, not even felons. I mean, don't they ask questions about general arrests on there now? And I mean, I know that I've spoken to some people who have had a hard time finding positions just because of things they have to put on their resume. So I'm just wondering if there's anything available to them. Do we target them at all to make sure that they're not on aid? We're helping them find them.
When we're working with people that have backgrounds, our biggest goal is to teach them how to pay attention to information that they're being requested, because it's all in how the questions are worded. So you might have a company that says, "Have you ever been convicted of anything other than a traffic ticket?"
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll get very specific to where you'll have people, "Have you been convicted of a felony in the last 7 years?" So that's a huge leap.
Absolutely.
So we try to educate the job seeker, and then we try to give them pointers on how to answer those questions, how to have elevator speeches prepared to be able to deal with that. And then on the other hand, we try to guide them towards industries that are more likely to accept someone that has a background more manufacturing-based, less healthcare-based.
Okay. I do have one more question. On your page with your statistics here, do we ever compare, when we're showing the unemployment rates, do we compare available jobs at the time? Do you see what I'm saying? Do we compare, these many people are saying they're unemployed, and this is how many jobs that we're finding being posted in the area? Do we ever do any kind of a comparison like that, just to see if there is a...
I didn't bring that information with me today, but I have presented that information to the committee in the past.
Okay.
That there are
okay.
statistics available
okay.
On that, and give very specific breakdowns on like part-time versus full-time, long-term versus short-term, all that good stuff. So it is available, and I can forward that to you.
And then, too, if somebody were to take... So I guess it is very just convoluted, because if somebody was let go from a full-time employment and they were to take something small part-time in the interim, they would be considered employed, even though they'd still be probably very actively looking. So, yeah, it seems...
And these numbers will adjust for, you know, 12 months down the road. We will get tweaks and adjustment to the numbers that happened last month.
If I could, just to answer two of your questions, I'll start with the second one and go to the first. The State Department of Workforce Development, on its website, not only do they have this information, but they also have the other that talks about how many jobs in your area per occupation. So you can make that comparison at home to do that. Both of those are available. They're in two different portions of the website, which is kind of a pain in the butt, but they do exist. To go to your first question, I did have a conversation with Secretary Newsom, who's the Secretary of Workforce Development, and some folks from the State Department of Corrections about employing folks who have had felonies on their record, as well as a conversation with some social justice advocates around that, too. And there's a lot of conversation, and there's starting to be some push in a few places for there to be money to be made for transitional job placement. So in other words, you're the employer,
the state or the feds pay you a certain chunk to take on somebody for maybe 5 months, 6 months, you see how they work out, and then you decide you want to hire them. It's been proven to be exceptionally effective. It's something that the Secretary of the Department of Children and Families, Eloise Anderson, has stated in the past that she was really in favor of and very strongly pushed. So if that's something that we want to take a look at, those statistics about folks who've got felonies and in terms of being underemployed or unemployed, I'm told they're available, but we'd probably have to get them from Madison. So if that's an interest that you have, we can certainly make the appropriate phone calls and try to take a look at that through this committee if you'd like.
Absolutely. I think that's, because I think that's one place where there could actually be a change. There's always going to be people who don't want to work. But I think that it's a different case when somebody is forced to be in a position, not that they were forced to commit a felony or whatever they did, but if they are avidly, actively trying to go out and get a job, it just seems like there should be some way to help them so that they're just not on aid over and over and over again, you know.
If that's something that you want to explore, we can make the phone calls, the appropriate emails, and try to do that. Okay, sorry. Does anyone have any questions up to this point? Sorry, please continue.
So I looked into the Careers Tools Conference, and as I stated, this was something that was put on by the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. They received a lot of, I don't want to say free, but amenities to be able to pull this off in the Milwaukee area. They had this at the Cousins Center, and that was actually donated to them. So their costs were extremely low to run this. And I do know that they ticketed people to be able to go to the event, much like one of the career fairs that we just had in May, and that there were a lot of tickets left unclaimed. Some of the topics that were included in this were the job readiness, the resume building, the interviewing tips and tricks, job search strategies, goal setting, financial management, image consulting, so how to dress, those types of things. All of these topics, and I provided the booklet with you, are covered in workshops that we hold weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, quarterly. I'd say about probably 95% of the things that they discuss there we offer to the community already. And this is something that I brought to the committee before, and you guys actually approved me to be able to make and distribute these on a quarterly basis. So when looking into what it would cost to be able to provide something like this basis versus what we already provide, I'm not sure it would be in the best interest of very limited funding.
The way I was looking at it when I saw all this is you have the staff that does a lot of this already, and you have the audience right there that might, you know, they're right there looking for work anyways, is hold a different session going, while this is going on, we also will be providing this in a separate room, you know, going, if you want to hear more about, you know, resumes, we will do this here. Because as I've watched people, if it's not right there, then it has to be somewhere else. They'll forget the date, what's going on. They'll forget what all the information they need when it comes to this. But if it's right there at the event, you know, teach them how to do a resume. You know, have that as a little seminar. Use the staff that's already here, not bring in outside individuals like they did, and that would make it cheaper as well. And just try to supplement, because when I've looked over friends' resumes, I've told them to please go over there, because I said, your tenses are wrong, you're not explaining yourself well. I said, you need to do something like this in order to sell yourself. And that's why I thought, you know, it's laying out the different things we could do and use that as a basis of just adding something more at the net, not this coming job fair, but the next job fair. Maybe that may help out some individuals as well. I don't know if that's...
If If I may, the major issue with that is when you're at the job fair, it's not the time then to tell somebody that, you know, you're dressed inappropriately. Here, let me work on your resume. Let me get those things done. That should have been work that was done before you walked in there. So, you know, one of the things we have put together is appropriate dress and attire. So we kept hearing from employers that people are showing up and not, you know, dressing professionally, or at least, you know, coming in with the cutoffs and their torn up shirts and stuff like that. So that was one of the workshops we put together as a result of that. If you did it at the job fair, it's a little, you know, that horse has already kind of left the barn by the time they walk through those doors. So it's not that some of that might be worth exploring. Maybe we could do a, if we see the resumes are really looking bad, just do a resume shop for people that are walking in with something that just isn't meeting the employer's needs.
And so we might have to look at changing a venue as well.
Correct.
As our current venues don't have areas space where we can do that. Mm-hmm. So we'd probably have to look at a different venue. And one of the nice things about the venue we have now is Gateway lets us use that space at no cost.
Mm-hmm. So. See, in my head when I originally thought of this was, gee, Parkside, do it along with Racine, you know. Things of that nature. I mean, when I looked at it, I'm just telling you what was in my head.
We did the Career Expo there. That the state came in with a $20,000 budget to be able for us to be able to hold that there. Mm-hmm. So if we were to look at doing something like that in combination with Racine, we'd probably be looking at about $10,000 per job fair just from Kenosha.
Okay, like I said, this is me looking at it going, gosh, this would be nice in a perfect world kind of thing.
Supervisor Johnson, did you have anything else, Supervisor Frederick?
No, I mean, this is, when I saw that, I thought it would be a nice idea for Kenosha.
Yeah, speaking to that point, and this is kind of why I was asking this. When I was with Abbott years ago, the whole time I was there, I was involved in an organization called Abbott Women Leaders in Action, and the project that I worked on the most was helping women who were leaving incarceration get back into the workforce. And it was all volunteer, and we helped them rebuild their resumes. We helped them with interviewing skills. We helped them with dressing skills. We also, I don't know why I focused on that, but we also worked with women in shelters who were trying to get out on their own. And just setting goals, just kind of just mentoring, professional women mentoring other women and just trying to help them get their life back. And I know there are a lot. I would. If you find somebody who needs help, call me. I'll put a resume. You know, I did it for years, and I enjoyed it very much. And we would usually meet in smaller groups. Sometimes it would be with a certain halfway house group or a certain shelter. So in smaller groups, we would do it. And you know, oddly enough, we were never short of volunteers to help. So, you know, that may be something. And I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, when they go to an interview, it's too late. And when they're in front of the employer, it's too late. But there are so many people in need. You just haven't been exposed to that kind of environment. And so it's a great way to help build up their confidence before they're standing in front of an employer.
It's a very passionate subject for me. For the 10 years prior, my workforce development was all in corrections.
Oh.
So I actually come with that background. But we do currently have two areas where we are serving this population. We have a Windows to Work grant, which is in combination with a regional grant, so in combination with Racine, where we actually have stuff that go into RCI 6 months prior to release, start working with individuals. And then once they get out, we follow them for 12 months. So it's an 18-month program, very intensive. And then locally right here, we have our PCDU unit, which is Professional Career Development Unit, that actually goes into Kenosha Huber and has a job readiness type style class where they deal with all of those issues, resume writing, how to dress, what jobs they should be looking
how
for.
How about everybody things. Else? How about, you know what I mean? How about just the woman who's been home forever and all of a sudden she's single and she has to get back into the workforce or somebody trying to get out of the shelter? Or, you know what I mean? Do we have any things up for them to help them?
We are as partner agencies mm-hmm. with those. We have brochures, flyers. We actually provide some funding to kids to be able to deal with some of those issues. So we are working hand in hand with all those partner organizations to get the word about what's available.
Any other questions?
Barnes, please continue.
That is actually all I had at that point, unless there were any other questions.
Well, I have a few. I wasn't going to ask anything, but I have a few. Is it possible to get some of the information Supervisor Johnson inquired about to the committee about what jobs are available in terms of those numbers? Like, I know where they are, but I know other folks may not.
We'll send that link out again, or do you want the actual documents?
All I need is...
Whichever.
I just asked because I thought I remembered it on there. I thought I remembered seeing it.
The second question is a little harder. Is it possible for us to get some of the other alternative measures for Kenosha County unemployment? Like, if you go for the federal, they have a couple different ways of measuring things out. I know the U6 is thought of as being, like, the most inclusive, but there's a couple others, U4, U3, U2, U1. I forget which one this is. I think this one actually might be U4 that we have in front of us. But so we could get that for county. And I don't know that that's necessarily available. I think it is if they calculate on the basis of metropolitan statistical area, which we're not considered one yet because we don't have enough people.
We are actually considered in an MSA, but it's with North Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. We're
so
not our own, like, Racine
yeah,
or Milwaukee. Or Yeah. So I don't know if that would be available, if maybe the state would do that.
I can ask our labor economist.
Yeah.
If we can get some of those numbers.
I forgot about her. Yeah, she'll be great. Yeah, awesome.
So when you say MSA, is it the acronym I'm used to? Master Service Agreement? Is that what you're saying?
Metropolitan Statistical
Okay.
Area.
Yeah,
it's
a designation used by the U.S. Department of Commerce once you hit a certain population size, and you get all kinds of information about your area. On a very frequent basis. So they're things
okay.
that we get once or twice a year in terms of data, whereas other counties, because they have a larger population, will get them on a monthly basis.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, it's a lot more monitoring and tracking things in more minutia that can actually be really helpful. That would be so nice if we got. So maybe for future reference, when you do come with this, if you bring some of that stuff too, would be really great. Because it makes me happy, I'll be honest. Hopefully it makes everybody else happy, too.
And it's all about making you happy.
It's really not, but, you know, it's things that we should all know. You know, it talks about, you know, the unemployment rate compared to men versus women on the basis of race and ethnicity, which, you know, in some places is only done yearly. Others it's done on a monthly basis. So stuff like that. Any questions? All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next agenda item, the Affordable Care Act update. Good evening, Ms. Green.
Okay, Diane, you need to speak up because they are recording.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. And I was here in May and I gave you an update on the Affordable Care Act, also known as the Marketplace, in some circles known as Obamacare. It is still targeted to launch the open enrollment period on October 1st of this year. That's when people can at least apply for the Marketplace or for Badger Care Plus, depending on what their circumstances are. There have been a number of changes in the Badger Care Plus program also related to the 100% federal poverty level. So come October 1st, we're anticipating in the WKRP area, which includes Kenosha and Racine, that the changes in the Badger Care Plus program as well as the open enrollment for the Marketplace will impact approximately 29,000 people. Either they will be now eligible for Badger Care Plus, no longer eligible for Badger Care Plus, and referred to the Marketplace. But that's the state projection, is at about 29,000 people within Kenosha and Racine will be impacted in some way. The state recognizes that there's a great workload associated with this open enrollment period and the Badger Care Plus changes. And in the governor's current biennial budget, he identified additional funding for consortia to hire additional people to manage the workload that's going to come. The money has been made available starting in July of this year. For the WKRP Consortium, our share of the company for the period July through December is $1.3 million. Kenosha's portion of that is about $643,000. And the expectation is that we would use that money to hire additional staff to help us make it through the influx of people that are expected to come. Kenosha did hire 11 temporary staff that started last week. They started last Monday. And they're in training right now because the training normally takes about 12 to 15 weeks. And we've condensed the training down to about 9 weeks, so they'll be ready by the middle of October to help us with the influx of the applicants and questions and calls that will come as a result of Affordable Care and Badger Care Plus changes. We're also going to use the money for overtime because with the influx of calls and additional activity that will take place, workers are going to be inundated with work. Can imagine 29,000 additional. Not that they'll come all at once. We understand they won't come all at once, but over the course of time, we expect that we'll be using overtime to help us manage and process the number of applications that will be coming. There are a number of meetings taking place in the community because the expectation is that we would form enrollment networks in all of the various communities so that the Job Center, as an example, and the Senior Workforce Development Center will not necessarily have all the folks flocking to us, but there will be partners within the community that can help answer some of the questions, refer them to the appropriate places. We've had a number of meetings with the state as well as our various community partners, some of whom were in the room earlier, because all of us are going to play a part in getting the message out there that people should enroll to see if they're eligible for either Badger Care Plus or the Marketplace. with Affordable Care, it's required that all individuals have some sort of health insurance coverage, or sometime in the future they may be penalized through their taxes. And so everyone needs to get the message to have some type of insurance. We have a community partners meeting scheduled on September 4th at 10:30. It's pretty much an all-day planning session from 10:30 till 3:30, where we're inviting all of our community partners, our healthcare partners, county board supervisors, if you choose, to come and attend this meeting. We're going to have a discussion to strategize on how we get the word out, how we get people to the right places, and what all of our collective roles should be. Because there will be people that are called navigators who help folks manipulate or navigate their way through the complexities of the system. There will be a group of people that are called certified application counselors who will help the public understand the various options that they have with affordable health care. And there will be insurance agents and brokers who will happily take the applications. And then there's another group of people, which our community partners will be mobilizers, educators, people who can get as many people to the right places as possible. And so we're going to come up with a comprehensive community strategy, hopefully, after this meeting, to say this partner is going to do this, this partner is going to do that, and hopefully it'll all work. there's lots of preparation that's taking place for Affordable Care. There's lots of training that has to take place. Our existing staff, because the Badger Care Plus rules are changing significantly, we had a training, an all-day training, on this past Friday, August 23rd. And we're told what the new standards are, what the new eligibility standards are, as well as what the modified adjusted gross income standards are, and it's called the MAGI. And it changes everything that we're doing come January 1. And so what's going to happen is that people who come to us October 1st will determine eligibility for them based on current rules. Come January 1st, all the rules change. And so then we have to redo their applications based on the new eligibility. And that's for existing people. So the plan is that come October 1, anybody who thinks they may be eligible can apply online, in person. And we will collect those applications, those who are eligible for Badger Care Plus, we will process them, make them eligible for Badger Care Plus under the current rules. If it looks like they're going to be eligible under the new rules, we're going to hang on to those cases until November 18th, when all the system changes will take place and plug in the new eligibility criteria. And that's why it's going to be kind of a double workload that we're going to have to be managing. We are preparing for questions and phone calls. Our staff are being trained. We're coming up with a new business model for managing all the calls and clients that come in. And hopefully we can put some of our staff at some of the community's sites so that we can handle the clients as they come in to other places and we don't have a lot of folks coming down to the job center. The state has given us a schedule of notices that they'll be sending out at various points so that we can anticipate when the influx of calls will come. And this is just for your information. Key dates for income maintenance folks to know what to expect. The first thing, I'm not going to go through this entire document. The first thing is between August 2nd and September 30th, all of us are going to be trained throughout the state on new Badger Care Plus rules and the changes that we want to occur starting in 2014. The first series of notices we lost September 23rd informing current Badger Care Plus members about the new income limits and let them know that many of them probably will not be eligible. Those are the calls that we're going to get. And then September 30th, another group of notices are going to go out to the single adults who, up to this point in time, some of them were eligible with an annual cost, and others were on a wait list. And those folks, if they meet the FPL, the federal poverty level, they will be eligible, so we'll get another wave of calls. So all this does is explain when the notices are going to go out. This is the timeline, when things are going to happen. Identify what they anticipate to be the workload impact on us so that we can prepare for it. Just trying to manage what we need to know is going to come October 1st. Just FYI, I have another piece of information for us because all of us, I think, have a part to play in this. This is just, you take one pass down. Anybody who may be interested in learning about the marketplace, there are a number of online trainings that last about an hour, and those are the dates. Anybody can go online and listen to how the marketplace is supposed to work, who it's going to impact, where people need to go. And so if you're interested in learning more about the marketplace, these are the dates that the training will be offered online. You're welcome to participate if you so choose. Just FYI, anybody, there's a website, healthcare.gov, and anyone can go on there, and it gives up-to-date information as to where things stand with the healthcare marketplace. But as far as we can tell, it will launch on October 1st.
Supervisor, we'll go around the table. Supervisor Johnson.
I just wanted to ask, you said that the state, we got just over 600 that left, 660,000?
It was actually, they give it to us according to consortia, they've mm-hmm. seen and Pinochet are combined, they gave us 1.3 million.
But which of ours is the Kenosha, I believe you said, was
yes,
our share was
643,000 because it's based on caseloads
yep.
and they have a higher caseload than we
sure.
have.
Sure. And you said that we've hired 11 temporary employees.
Mm-hmm.
How long do we plan on having them for?
They're budgeted through the end of next year. and they came in knowing that they're temporary employees, that they were hired for this particular project. What we know is going to happen is that once we've determined eligibility for Marketplace versus BadgerCare Plus, there'll be a number of these cases that remain with us. And once we sort this out, we'll have to maintain some of these staff, and so we'll take that through a budget process.
That's what I was going to get at next. You know, my question is, as we're preparing for this, mm-hmm. because I'm assuming that that's all we get. Do we get more if we need more?
Well,
within the next
that
year.
That was in the governor's biennial budget. There's more identified. The portion that I told you about was just for the last 6 months of this year.
Okay.
And because we're getting started kind of late in terms of hiring these temporary people, we're not going to spend all of that money in the last 6 months of this year. And we can carry it over into the following year. And there's additional money identified in 2014 and 15 because they know the impact is going
to be. What I'm getting at is that, and I'm just assuming this, so I could be wrong, but mm-hmm. I would assume that as soon as this is enacted, initially we're going to be bombarded, mm-hmm. and then later on it would taper off. So is the plan for these 11 people the max, and this will taper off?
It tapers off, and then it picks up again. The open enrollment period is every October, just like an insurance plan. And so this is...
Are you anticipating a lot more activity having to be done just because of the chaotic changes to everything?
During the first 6 months, I expect yes. there to be lots and lots of additional activity that takes place.
Okay, so that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. Did we consider that in the headcount? Okay.
I mean, we
have enough with 11.
Oh, I don't think we have enough. But,
okay.
But I mean, we'll work with what we have. We have 11. The same hired 9 for a total of 20 within the consortium itself. Mm-hmm. And so
they have more money, but they only hired 9.
I'm sorry.
They had more money. They actually got more money than us. So
because they. You can use the money for a variety of things. It's not just for hiring staff. I mean, there's computer equipment that we have to buy also for these folks. We're seeing because their setup is much different than ours. They're a much smaller office. They're making cosmetic changes in their building itself, and so they're using part of their money to have a building remodel. And it's perfectly awful.
Like our school board superintendent.
Okay.
Anything else, Supervisor Johnson?
No, that's it.
Supervisor Frederick?
So I'm a little bit clear. Is mm-hmm. everybody who's on any sort of BadgerCare going to have to deal with the changes over the next few months? Or is it just the BadgerCare Plus people? Or
If I understand your question correctly, it's primarily the adults that are on BadgerCare Plus. The children who are receiving BadgerCare Plus, things don't change for them very much. The children remain eligible. It's the adults. And so what we're going to have is we're going to have cases where the children are on BadgerCare Plus, in some instances, that until we go through the whole scenario, we won't know what we have. But the children will remain eligible for BadgerCare Plus. Some of the parents will remain eligible also if they meet that 100% FPL. If they're above that, then they will move to the marketplace. And so we'll have cases, we call them mixed cases, where you have the kids in one situation, the adults in another situation, but that's for medical. For food share, they're all being on the same case. And so it's not like the workload is going to be less, it's going to be more challenging because we have many more dynamics that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anything else? Mm-hmm. Supervisor Nittle, do you have anything? Supervisor Decker?
Yeah, sure. What are the different policies that are going to be available in the exchanges?
I'm sorry, what are the different policies?
Yes, health insurance policies.
I don't know a whole lot about the marketplace. I can tell you that there are three, in Southeast Wisconsin, there are three providers.
Four.
I'll give you their names. Molina, Common Ground, and CompCare are going to be the three healthcare organizations. They have four levels of coverage, and the specifics I can't really tell you. There is a bronze plan, there is a silver plan, there's a gold plan, there's a platinum plan. And the difference is the platinum plan costs the most premium-wise, but the out-of-pocket costs are minimal. And on the bottom end, you pay a small premium for the bronze, but your out-of-pocket costs will be higher. And so people will be, based on their income and their circumstances, have to decide which of the four levels they can afford, and then they'll have to pick one of these three providers to.
So each of the providers provides a gold, mm-hmm. silver, bronze,
mm-hmm.
and platinum?
Yes.
And are they all the same, or are they different?
That I don't know. The specifics I don't know, but I would think that they'd be very similar, because.
Okay, and. Is that something that at the county employees that are helping the people
mm-hmm.
that come in, will they have to know that, or they just have to say, your income's this,
choices.
This,
yeah,
or this
yeah.
is your income, you can
mm-hmm.
choose that, and then they send them
right.
where to go?
It's the agents and the brokers hired by the insurance companies that will take them through,
okay.
the specifics of the
So once we find out their income level and which plan they go in, either Badger Care or
the marketplace,
mm-hmm. then we say, okay, call these people.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Supervisor Decker, the rates for those plans have not yet been released. Allegedly, the state knows what they are and are doing something, I guess, with the data, but for one reason or another, they haven't been released yet. There has been a fourth provider, if I'm not mistaken, that's recently come on board. As of, I think, Friday, Dean Healthcare, primarily out of the Dane County area, has somehow, I guess, been approved also to service this area. So we're
Dean.
Yeah, we're up to four for the marketplace. So, and that should hopefully be, you know, more information about that coming out hopefully soon, but it's one of these things you got to keep your eyes peeled. Do you have anything else, Supervisor Dodge?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Supervisor Dodge?
Yes, I got two questions. And, brought up by another supervisor. One question was the opportunity for somebody, if they do not take a health care plan, gets fined at the end of the year. Was told between $90 and $100 per person if they don't take the insurance. Now, people can figure out now, if I'm going to buy the insurance, it's going to cost me a lot more than $100 a year. So I would just not buy the insurance until now I know I need it. And now I can't be precluded from a pre-existing condition, so at that time I can go in and buy your premium plan. Is that possible?
I'll say this, I'll answer your question this way. The open enrollment period for 2014 is a 6-month period. It goes from October 1 to March 31st, and people who fall outside that window then they don't have the opportunity to buy the insurance. And if they opt not to and want to pay the penalty, the per person penalty in 2014 when they file their taxes, that is absolutely correct. Over the course of time, the penalty gets higher and higher. First year is kind of a test year, and that's why the penalty is so low. But if they continue to do that, the penalty will be much, much higher over the course of time.
Okay, my second question to you, this was brought up. Let's say, for example, I have my own business and I employ, let's say, 17 people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not required under the Affordable Care Act because I have less than 50 people to provide insurance. However, how will the Affordable Care Act affect what I'm paying now?
You're not required at all until 2015, but the employer mandate went away. And so, irregardless whether you have 50 people or 17 people, you don't have to.
Yes, but will the Affordable Care Act change all the insurance premiums for everybody? Will it have a devastating effect on my cost for my employees' insurance? This was brought up on the county board floor. That's why I was wondering.
Okay. And I don't know quite honestly enough about the Affordable Care Act. I've not been trained in that particular piece of it to answer that question intelligently.
Supervisor Dash, I try to address some of your question there. Much of the conversation the feds have been having around how the Affordable Care Act will affect businesses has been delayed. We know a lot more about what's going to happen with individuals and families than we do about businesses. They're still working that portion out in terms of what that's going to look like and who specifically that's going to affect and so forth, which is one of the reasons why I didn't talk about it, because it wasn't enough information to really deliver anything substantial. So as far as folks deciding to not purchase because the tax hit is cheaper than actually buying, it would depend on how much it is that they make and where they're working. Chances are they might already have some sort of insurance that would meet the federal criteria of the Affordable Care Act. There's some folks who currently have insurance provided by their employer, but it doesn't meet the criteria under the law, and so they're going to have to look to the marketplace to find something else. So it just depends, and there are subsidies available, but it's going to vary according to your income, what plan you get, how many kids you've got. So there's all those little marketplace variables, which is why also I separated it out from talking about committee stuff. It's a whole different animal.
Okay.
Any other questions for Ms. Green?
I just have one quick one.
Supervisor Johnson.
Do life-changing events open enrollment for people?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the only question. Yes, it does.
Was there anything else?
I just wanted to say to Rick, too, that when they were going to put it forward the way it originally was, too, it was going to cost a lot of smaller business owners so much that they would have been better off taking the fines. And a lot of them had come forward and said that's what they planned on doing, taking the fines instead of just the way you were saying a single family or an individual would choose to pay the fine because it would be less expensive. So, yeah, it's kind of a mess.
I do have one quick question. As far as specifically how many folks we have on Badger Care currently, I've seen an estimate from the State Department of Health Services that I think puts it at 15%, if I'm not mistaken, of the Kenosha County population.
That sounds about right.
Okay.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it was an estimate based off of, I think, 159,000 done between 2008 and 2010, released in 2012. This is the most recent number I can find. Was there information by county on poverty and health insurance statistics? So I don't know if there's something more current, if we know specifically what percentage. I mean, I know we keep our own numbers as to who's on what. Usually, sometimes the state has them in more detail. But if we could get that, that would be fantastic.
And so I'm clear on what it is you're looking for?
We want to know how many folks are on some form of Badger Care that would.
Okay. In Kenosha.
Yeah,
okay.
In Kenosha.
All right.
Because I mean, I see.
I guess the real good one would be to know how many adults are on Badger Care that are going to be coming off that we anticipate actually are going to be impacted by the change, too.
If you've got stats for folks on Badger Care, we'd love to see it.
Absolutely.
That would be helpful in terms of understanding this.
How many people in Kenosha that are currently on Badger Care?
The adults that we anticipate are going to have to.
And there are other forms of medical assistance programs aside from Badger Care.
Sure.
Will those also be affected by the ACA?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just the Badger.
Just the Badger. Okay.
The adults.
Yeah, and I raise that because I think that the study put out by DHS also said that we had 7% uninsured. And so, you know, the number of folks in entirety that might be affected by the ACA was creeping pretty close to 25%, which out of roughly 170,000 puts you to about 40-some thousand people, which is huge.
Well, actually, 100% of the people are going to be affected by the Affordable Care Act.
But particularly folks that will be more intimately involved than others. Thank you.
Would you like another report in 3 months?
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea, yes.
And you'll have to know if you have enough people. Mm-hmm. It'd be quite challenging. Quite challenging.
We'll manage.
You guys do. You always do wonderfully. With so little, it's just amazing. You know, it's just absolutely amazing.
The staff are tremendous. They really are.
Yep. Absolutely.
And I have some other questions around this, so if I can borrow you after, that'd be awesome.
Sure.
You know, she's
the most panic looked I've ever seen.
It's after 8 o'clock. She's got nowhere to be.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'll stick around.
Motion adjourned.
No,
sorry.
There's other things on the agenda.
There's just any other business allowed by, well, committee member comments, usually. I don't have it in front of me, so close them. Oh, back to the question that you asked about family size. Sorry.
I didn't.
Earlier.
What? I'm just kidding.
No. I have it if you want.
Okay, I'm kidding. I'm still
so
kidding.
I'll just...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. What is it? It's any other business allowed by law, right? That's what it says. That's what I thought. I don't think that there is any. Is there a motion
Committee
to...
member comments.
Okay, I forgot to write that down. Committee member comments? Are there any? Okay.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Decker. Second by Supervisor Frederick. Evening governance.
Aye.
Committee.
Aye.
No.
She votes aye.
Aye.
Female
Supervisor
Nudo
is going to stay here
no
a while.
No husband present with own child under 18.
You said no.
Well, but I was on board.
6,112 and 3,897.
City and county? Or city and not
that's